Okay, so today I've chosen a reading from the Venerable Ajahn Wanchai. This is from the book Fighting for Freedom Within. And there's, I think, a sort of one large talk. It's a collection or compilation of talks, and then a bunch of smaller sort of teachings at the end. And I thought I'd just start from the beginning and see how far I make it through. Actually, I'll place, I guess, the second talk, because it was the second talk that really struck me when I read this. So, this is called A Higher Training. There is no training more difficult than the training of oneself. Training oneself is truly more difficult than anything else, and most difficult as all is the training of one's own mind. You can train yourself out of old habits of speech and action and into new ones in a reasonably short time span. The mind, however, is something that will take a fairly long time to develop for meditation practitioners of this day and age, no matter how hard they try. The mind is something naturally swift. It moves faster than anything else. The speed of man-made machinery or the various kinds of electronic devices we build today could never match the speed of the mind. In the span of not even a single second, it can shoot off to many different places before you are even aware of what has happened. Look into your own heart, and you will see, and what you will see will confirm what the Buddha taught when he said that there is nothing faster than the mind. So if you are going to bring all this moving around to a halt, then you really have to try and give your practice everything you've got. If you want to understand your own mind, then you need a method for doing so. You may have studied the mind and have some understanding of how the mind works, but if you don't actually use a practical method to work with the mind, then you'll never really see or understand. You already have a system of training to follow, which outlines various methods of self-discipline and etiquette in terms of the way you speak and act. When you train yourself in your external behavior like this, you are necessarily training yourself internally as well, because the mind is the controller. It is that which makes you act and speak in the way that you do. So as meditation practitioners, both as monks and lay people, you should start training yourselves with these methods. Take your sleeping habits, for example. This is an area that you have to train yourself in. Even when you feel drowsy, you shouldn't just give in and indulge in sleep. In the rains retreat period, for instance, you should hold to a practice of not going to bed before 10 at night under any circumstances. The Buddha taught us to practice consistently like this. So long as you are in a strong enough state to stay awake, then you don't go to bed before 10 at night, no matter what. These are the kinds of skillful means that you have to bring to your practice in order to help yourself. In the past, you would just indulge in your desire for sleep whenever you felt like it, but now you want to understand the workings of your own mind, so you have to find methods that help you to do that. You have to keep applying standards that help you to change your old habits, the habits of simply following the desires and indulging in mental proliferation. Not going to bed before 10 at night would be one example of how you might do this. Try to develop skillful means in your practice. Make a personal determination, a vow to keep going no matter how drowsy you feel. Then, when it reaches 2 a.m. or 3 a.m., get up no matter what. This basic kind of self-discipline is for your own good. It's for the sake of your own heart and mind. It's a way of teaching yourself and training yourself. In the past, you would always have an excuse to keep sleeping. It's too hot. It's too cold. I don't feel so well. I'll just get a bit more sleep. The excuses will keep coming. When you keep following that habit, then you will find that you can't get up in the morning. So you have to be strict about it. No matter how you feel, don't give up until you drop. Don't give in until you drop. As a result of this, the heart actually grows stronger because of its ability to push itself. In the past, all it ever did was give in to the weakness of the body and the influence of the defilements. The defilements like making excuses. Sometimes they use the state of your health as an excuse. Sometimes they use feelings of pain or pleasure as an excuse. Sometimes they use other duties or work projects as an excuse. As a result, you end up not being able to practice in the way you know you should. When it's time to be strict with yourself, then be strict. Train yourself to stay up and not to go to bed before a specific time. If it has already passed 10 p.m. and you feel no need to sleep, then fine. Keep putting effort into your meditation. But you will still get up at the time you set for yourself in the morning, even if you end up going to bed late. That's right. That's how the enlightened teachers really train themselves. At first, you might train yourself by using an alarm clock. When it goes off, it wakes you with a start, and you get up straight away, wash your face, and start sitting in meditation. If you feel drowsy, then go and do some walking meditation. Later on, you don't need the alarm clock anymore. When you wake up in the morning, you may look at the clock and find that you have woken up at about the same time as you did when you set the alarm clock. Waking up at this time has become an ingrained habit now, and it is a habit that gives you a sense of wholesome pride because you know in your heart for yourself that you can do it. Who would have thought that putting yourself through this kind of training would ever give any good results? You didn't think it would, but it does. It makes you feel proud of yourself because you know that at least you have overcome your own laziness. You have endured some physical hardship, and you have resisted defilements that were previously pushing you around. The defilements like sleep because it's an easy thing to do. When you are asleep, you don't have to be aware of anything or do anything at all, and that is nice. And that is a nice place to be. However, once you have trained yourself to the point where you know that you can resist these habits, you can feel proud of yourself because you know that you are doing better than before. I can do this. Even if you have improved by just a fraction, this is still a good thing. It's like one drop of water in a jar. If there aren't any cracks in the bottom of the jar, then a single drop is still an increase in volume. When you start meditating and doing battle with your defilements, then you start to see that there's nothing more difficult to train, nothing more difficult to teach than your own heart and mind. You think it's going to be easy, but when you actually do it, it isn't long before you've given in to the influence of the obstacles and distractions that are pulling you away from your meditation practice, pulling you off course and in another direction. The path of practice that the Buddha and the enlightened teachers have handed down to us is not only the best path to take, it's the only one. It's the one and only way to quell the wild nature of the heart. There is no other way, no other field of study or practice that can do this. Any other form of knowledge or study will just pull the mind outwards more and more. People aren't satisfied by seeing this world alone, so they find ways of getting to other planets too, the moon or the planet Mars, to such immense distances as that. The only type of study that's capable of bringing all your mental proliferation to stillness, of quelling your feelings of pleasure and pain, is that of the Buddha's wisdom. On the more basic level of external behavior, the Buddha Dhamma first teaches you to stop any kind of unwholesome activities, and to develop more wholesome activities, wholesome ways of behaving. On the more refined level of meditation practice, then you learn to bring all external activities to a complete halt, so the only activity remaining is that of the meditation practice, for example, sitting or walking meditation. It is from this point that you begin to still the mental activity of the mind and the defilements that were previously pushing the mind outward all along, out to the moon, out to Mars, or anywhere at all. When the defilements are controlling the mind, there is no limit to how far outward they can take it. They can take it anywhere whatsoever. So now you have to pull it back inside and observe it. Make it stay put internally by fixing your mindfulness on whichever meditation where you choose. It's like catching a wild animal and trying to tie it down. First you catch it, and then you muzzle it. Once you've got that wild animal on a leash, it can't go off that far. It can't go rampaging like it did before. Your mind is the same. It's wild and it's roguish. It leads you to suffering and trouble. The minds of all beings in this world lead them into suffering and trouble. But now you're going to catch it, right now. Once you are determined to catch it, then you have to do it by taking up a meditation object and fixing your mindfulness on it. Grab hold of whichever meditation object you find works best for you, whichever one you find easiest to use, and then tie your mind to that object, such as the internal recitation of the word Buddho. Establishing mindfulness is like tying yourself up with a rope. You have to rein in the flow of the mind, not letting it go out in any other direction whatsoever. This is when the meditator, the fighter, will start to see just how seriously difficult the task really is. There's nothing more difficult than this. Building skyscrapers, mansions, airplanes, and trains are all things that can be achieved through sufficient study or book learning, but the training of the mind is a different matter entirely. There is no way on earth you will ever be able to develop it through mere book learning. If you were to read the entire Tripitaka 100 times over, it still wouldn't be enough to make your mind peaceful. The practice is not just about reading the Buddha's teachings and committing them to memory. Take them away and try to actually put them into practice. Then you will see their value, their true value. As soon as you really try putting the teachings into practice, however, you will find that not even a few seconds have gone by before you meet with your first obstacle, the wild nature of your own mind. It is already kicking and struggling in an attempt to get back into its familiar territory, mental proliferation. All it will take is a few moments of observation before you see just how incredibly wild and exuberant your mind really is. You see that all your restless agitation comes from right here inside. In the beginning of meditation practice, you can't keep your mind focused at all. You don't have a clue how the mind manages to keep slipping away like it does. You are meditating, reciting Buddho, 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 and before you know it, the mind has already slipped off again and you've lost it. How does it keep doing that? It gradually steps out for a bit, bit by bit, away from the meditation object. How? You don't know. And before you know it, you are already caught up in another train of thought. So you sit there thinking to yourself, hey, I'm trying to meditate here. Why is my mind like this, still like this? It's the defilements. They are back again to ruin your meditation by distracting you with yet another train of proliferation. In life, you desire things and feel bad when you don't get them. This carries over into Dhamma practice. You want to get something from it. When you start to practice the defilements interfere, making you want to get results quickly. When you don't get them, the mind becomes agitated. As you walk the path of Dhamma, they also know this is the one thing that can conquer them, so they try to obstruct you in every way and use every trick to pull you off the path. That's how the defilements work. At this point, you still can't actually see the mind itself. You don't know exactly what it is, but you can see its outer expressions and activities. You can see states of agitation and restless proliferation. You can see the mind constantly slipping away, off into trains of scattered proliferation that you can't keep up with. So after half an hour or a full hour, just how many recitations of Buddho have you actually completed? How much time have you spent actually focusing on your meditation object? Looking at the way things are going, you might start to feel down on yourself, thinking, oh, seriously, why am I even bothering trying to do this? I don't even have any good qualities at all. You can't seem to control your own mind at all, but why is that? It's because you've been living as a devotee of the defilements for a very, very long time. That is why your mind is so adept at following them, so adept at proliferating and engaging with all the issues that the defilements cook up. These days and nights just keep passing by. Time keeps moving on, yet after all this time, you've never actually seen your defilements face to face. You are only just starting to recognize some of their outer expressions and activities, but you still haven't seen them clearly. You can see some of the ways that they pull your mind back out into mental proliferation, that they make your mind kick and wriggle, and prevent you from putting effort into your meditation practice. They stop you from seeing your own true original mind. They stop you from seeing its true base. In the beginning, you feel down about these things. Yet in one way, that sense of sorrow actually helps to weaken the power that the defilements have over your mind. It gives rise to a sense of dispassion, a feeling of being fed up with the various types of proliferation that you keep getting caught up in. When the mind starts proliferating, you don't want to follow it because you know that it just keeps landing you right back in the same old place as before. The first thing you have to do in your meditation practice is track down your mind by following and observing its movement and activities. You have to be a bit like a detective who is trying to catch a criminal. At first, the detective doesn't know who the offender actually is, so he has to start tracking the offender down by looking for witnesses and various types of evidence. He investigates the crime scene in different ways. He follows clues, and he gradually zeroes in on the culprit and catches him. Your practice is just the same. You have to keep track of your mental activity, observing the mind's movements, and then catching it out by fixing it on a meditation object. Watch how it tries to get away from that object. Then you catch it out. Keep observing the mind continually. Keep catching the mind and drawing it back to your meditation object every time it tries to escape, tries to move back into thinking and fantasizing. When you do this, you will find that although you have some degree of self-awareness, your mind still manages to slip into yet another fantasy before you even know what has happened. You start to see more and more clearly just how incredibly strong these habits of mind really are, even when you are sincerely trying to meditate. The average person out there who has never had any of these teachings doesn't have a hope of understanding these things. As for you, you are starting to understand, starting to know the truth about the beings of this world. As they say, when you practice meditation, you become loka vidu, a knower of the world, because everybody's mind functions in the same way. So if you, the ones who are studying and practicing meditation, are still unable to get a grip on your mind, what could be said for those who have never studied or practiced any of this, never tried training their minds at all? Think about it. Whatever species, race, social status, age, or gender they may be, the beings of this world are all the same in this respect. They have no idea what they're living, that they're living completely under the influence of their own defilements and being burnt by them around the clock. You will come to a point in your practice where you start to see that there is no point in wanting to become a person of great social status, and so you will start to lose interest in such things. You won't desire these things anymore because you know that even if you achieve them, they can't in any way improve the state of your heart and mind. Whenever you go to work, it will be just a matter of someone putting you in a uniform. Your state of mind will be the same no matter what. Even if you become a millionaire, all you will have are those banknotes and numbers. Your heart will be the same old heart, right there, and it will be as wild and difficult to control as before. At this stage in your spiritual practice, you may already have a sense of satisfaction. After all, you are at least making the effort to practice meditation, and that alone is a blessing. You may feel a sense of contentment in the knowledge that you are doing what you are doing, in being who you are right here and right now. All those thoughts about wanting to become this or that type of person, or go to this or that place, have settled down and come to a halt. You are not proliferating as much anymore, and the mind's flow of awareness has been driven down and brought to something of a halt. The flow of the mind has been dammed, restrained, and controlled through the power of the Dhamma, through the power of training and meditation practice. The flow of thoughts has narrowed, and so the mind isn't going off to other planets in outer space like it used to, because you know that there is no point. What would you want to go to another planet for, anyway? Wherever you go, whichever planet you are on, it will still be just the same old you that goes there. Nothing would have really changed. You will just go on the experience to experience the results of whatever karma you make in that place, good or bad, in the same way that you do so here. You will just experience the same types of pleasure and pain that you experience here and now. Try and understand this. Wherever you go, whatever you do, it is just the same old person going back to those places or doing those things. It is just the same old heart and mind, this one right here. So what's the point of struggling after those worldly experiences? You just end up entangling in your own mental confusion and suffering in the same old way. You go seeking various kinds of new experiences in the same way that you always have, but you never find any substance in it. Now you can see this. This is how you use wisdom to cut off the flow of defilements, that push the mind out externally in so many different ways. As you keep cutting off that flow, you will see the mind gradually moving back inward, bit by bit. And once you are able to cut off that flow significantly, it gathers and unifies internally. There is simply no other method of study, apart from that of the Buddha Dhamma, that is capable of bringing trains of mental proliferation to a halt. Have you realized this for yourself yet? Worldly forms of knowledge and intelligence simply increase mental proliferation to the point where you can't stop thinking at all, and they have never given you any real happiness. The teachings that the Buddha gave us encompass everything in existence. He gave us the main path of practice, but let us decide which way we would walk. He taught us which path in life leads where, from the highest path that leads to complete liberation down to the lowest path, which will only bog you down in the worst kinds of suffering. He taught about everything in existence. We say that the Buddha attained enlightenment, but what does this mean? He became enlightened to the Dhamma, or the true nature of reality. He didn't teach about anything new, anything that wasn't there to begin with, nor did he hide the truth of what was. He didn't eliminate anything, and he didn't bring anything new into existence. He simply saw the true nature of all things, just as they are. Isn't that worth contemplating? The true nature of all things in existence, just as they are. All phenomena that exist right here with us, right here in the place we are living, and any other place we go, in fact, everywhere. Yet we don't live with the truth at all. We live with a completely false understanding of reality. This is how the Buddha and enlightened beings are different from us. They live with the true nature of reality. They attained enlightenment, and that means knowledge and vision of truth. For instance, let us take the true nature of the physical body. Having made an internal investigation of his physical body, the Buddha understood the true nature of that body. He observed that it was compromised of various physical elements that came together in the beginning of life and then ultimately disintegrate and break down at life's end, going their separate ways. Can you really find any substance in this body which could be called a self or me or mine? Can you find anything lasting or permanent within it? Can you find a true source of pleasure in it? If you see the true nature of your own body, then you will see the true nature of every physical body throughout the entire world. You will see every living being in the future, and every living being from the past, because all bodies are of the same nature. Other bodies aren't any different from the one you've got right here. So there are different types of understanding. There is the average person's understanding, the false understanding of defilement, and the Buddha's understanding, which comes from true insight into reality. This is what we call enlightenment, or seeing the Dhamma. It is a state of enlightened knowing of the true nature of all things, the true nature of physical forms, feelings, memories, and perceptions, through thought formations and sense consciousness. The truth about the higher realms of heavenly existence, the lower realms of hell, and the entire cycle of birth and death. Having come to a conclusive understanding of everything, there was nothing more to know. That was the end of the story. But there was nothing else in the world, or any other world, that the Buddha needed to know, however many worlds there might be, because he had come to the end of them all. When you attain insight into the true nature of the physical body, then you let it go in line with its true nature. If it's going to age, then fine, so be it. If it's going to fall ill, it's going to fall ill. And if it's going to die, then it's going to die. You simply stop resisting the truth. But before you had this kind of understanding, all you were ever doing was resisting the truth and living in a false reality, a realm of delusion, weren't you? Think back to when the body was a child. It seemed like a permanent us that would stay like that forever. The way you perceive it now is just the same. Can you see that? A mind that is completely ignorant of the truth will see the body completely as me. That's the misunderstanding that you make, the misunderstanding of your body as being something permanent. You then try to get sensual pleasure from this body because you see it as a lasting source of happiness. You completely fail to see it as the pile of suffering that it really is. You completely mistake it for me and mine, and the perception never changes. People never think to see it in any other way. When you are practicing meditation, train the mind to stay focused on the internal recitation of the word Buddha or any other meditation object. Don't think about anything else whatsoever. Whether the mind is peaceful or not, whether there are feelings of lightness or heaviness, whether you see bright lights or you don't show any interest at all. Remember this point very well. Don't pay any attention to anything else in the entire world apart from the word Buddha. If the mind feels light, don't show any interest. Or if it feels like it's gathering inwardly, or it feels like it's about to enter a state of peace, still show no interest. You can't afford to get distracted by these things, or the mind's attention will become divided. Once the mind becomes divided in two, the defilements will keep pushing it out into further thoughts and distractions without end. It will go from 2 to 3 to 4 to 5. Even just to achieve a little bit of peace, you have to give up interest in absolutely everything apart from your meditation world. You have to keep the mind right there, and right there only. Whatever is happening, even if you feel like you are rising up or falling down, don't be in the least bit concerned. Once the mind has gained a reasonable amount of peace, you might be sitting in meditation and find that you have lost awareness of what you are facing. This is because the mind's flow of conscious awareness is beginning to withdraw internally from its usual attachment to the physical body. You might think, hey, which way am I facing? A moment ago I was facing that way, but now I'm not sure. At this stage, the peace of the mind is fairly weak. But if you are sitting there and can't tell your back from your front, it means that the mind has withdrawn internally to some degree. At this point, you must keep focusing solely on your meditation object. Do not pay attention to any visions that might arise. This is where they tend to start coming up, when the mind starts drawing inwards. The mind may then become fascinated by them and so forget its meditation object. The body and mind feel light, so you become more and more engrossed in the pleasure of that experience until your mindfulness breaks away from your meditation object. People who tend to get visions coming up in their meditation practice might find that visions arise at this point. Some might see bright lights. Whatever the experience may be, if you start to get fascinated and delight in it, it will distract you from your meditation word and prevent the mind from entering any further states of peace. The correct method is to show no interest in any of these things at all. If the mind is bright, then let it be bright. If it's dark, then let it be dark. If the mind is light, then let it be light. Cultivate a neutral attitude to all of these things. The only thing you have to do is keep focusing on your meditation object for as long as you can, with unbroken continuity. Buddho, 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 buddho. Whether you are using a meditation word, the breath, or a body part, just keep holding on to that object alone, and all these other experiences will eventually drop away completely. You will then pass through these things. You'll keep passing through the brightness and various visions. You'll keep passing through different experiences until you reach the true base of the mind.
Of all the Thai forest masters seem to give very clear presentations of the way they attained or found a peace of mind. I'm wondering if there's anything written about how Bangkok was reacting to these forest masters who are finally coming out and saying, actually, attainment is possible, and how they were answering when Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Mahabua, all of these masters said, yeah, it's...
I mean, first, they're Northeasterners, so they're not really, it's kind of, they're pretty weird anyway, on that level. So it wasn't really, didn't really take much attention. And then there was a certain amount of suspicion and a Mostly just kind of indifference. And then there was a bit of suspicion. And the... but generally it was sort of, you know, off in the northeast of Thailand, and in those days communication was not all that universal. So there was mostly word of mouth. And so it was mostly word of mouth in, you know, amongst circles of practitioners, so that there started to be a slow momentum of people who were interested. But mostly it was, you know, hardly even recognized in Bangkok or Central Thailand. You know, it was just... Ajahn Lee was the first of the forest monks to go to Central Thailand. It was more on the east, kind of east coast, not sort of Bangkok area, but so that people started to gain faith in him and the tradition. The biggest impact was probably in the the 1960s, when the king and queen started to get interested, and that put a whole stamp of authority on it. So that it's hard to underestimate how important that was. I was also, so I was actually just, showing Debbie some pictures yesterday of my trip to Thailand, and one of the talks that I gave a day long in English, and one of the people who came for the afternoon session, was a police general, former head of security for the king, and he was the person who took John Coleman, who was a contemporary of Goenkaji, to Burma to learn how to meditate, and. So, you know, there started to be within those circles, the kind of royal circles, and that was a big effect.
Change subjects slightly. Ajahn Chah, you recommended, you know, like just getting up as soon as you wake up. You have some interesting practices you did. Like use the toothbrush.
Yeah. I did that a couple times, but it was that's in the days before. If you put your toothbrush on your clock, so you can't just put the toothpaste on, put your toothbrush out, and then where your clock is, and then as soon as your alarm goes off, you pick up your toothbrush and put it in your mouth. And you've got to get up, sort of roll over there. This is, of course, snooze. I would put two or three glasses of water, not full, but, you know, about a couple inches of water, right beside where I was sleeping, so that I had no place to sort of roll around, and I had to be extremely mindful of if different, moved in the night without mindfulness. It was sort of like basically right next to the, so that, and then if, because getting up in the morning isn't, it's also sort of the mindfulness that you continue through the night that's important. So that if there's that alertness through the night, then when it gets time to wake up in the morning and you're awake, you just rest the body and then get up. So that and then if you know really lost mindfulness during the night, then there'd be a puzzle in the morning. So that was those are ways of working thoughts of just doing sitter's practice. That those are I did a lot of sitter's practice doing, which is just the body is able to sleep and then just get going. In the morning. Yeah, those are a few ways of it.
Didn't Ajahn Lanchai talked about the ignoring limits and going back to object. Did Ajahn Chah, I mean, I would imagine he had different approaches for different students, but did he also suggest that, like if students approached him with limits?
Yeah, yeah. For the most part, just don't get caught up in an impermanent phenomenon. Just come back to the breath. Make the mind peaceful. There's more. Because it's especially, I mean, in this talk, he talked a lot about the proliferation, speculation. So that nimittas in meditation are a great source of internal speculation. And then you go to your friends in the morning and you talk about your nimittas and you just keep it churning and the mind it doesn't really settle down. So that sense of just letting the mind say whatever nimitta arises, just to recognize. And it's not sort of pushing it away, but it's sort of acknowledging it, recognizing, okay, that's there. And coming back to making the mind peaceful, to not making a story out of it.
Like I said, if it's a useful object that just keeps coming up and it's clear and just is stabilizing or peaceful, then it can be useful if you're not.
It could be useful.
If you're not.
Yeah, but the tendency is to either speculate around it or proliferate around it or create a story around it or get really fascinated with it. That tendency will end up being a distraction. Mm-hmm. Yes.
With investigating sleep, and I'm curious because for me at least, I find sleeping less seems to be more an effect of good meditation practice than a cause.
Mm-hmm.
In that when Ajahn Dunn was here, and then again now, my sleep has just dropped. More than I. Wow. And I don't need so much. I don't need so much sleep. And it's not like I'm trying. Something else has happened,
mm-hmm.
And it seems to. I'm curious. Obviously, I'm investigating what the causes are. It's probably just less proliferation.
Yeah.
But is that?
Well, sometimes it goes both ways, in the sense of, sleep is a great way of just being able to annihilate oneself for a while and not have to deal with anything. But then that tends to build up a dullness in the mind, so that one needs to push oneself so that one isn't just falling into it, because that becomes a habitual pattern also. So it works both ways. Just bringing up energy to not get caught in sleep habits or sleep patterns, brings up energy in the mind, which is then results in less sleep. So that energy, learning how to energize the mind. And which is a good skill, rather than waiting for conditions, external conditions to be something that ends up in that, recognizing, there's things that I can be doing to facilitate that.
Okay.